point that you have, it will be.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Today, the most important thing is to divide the task so we can start writing in parallel.
Sure.
Right? But so we have four graphs. So MVC. So these two are Kashmir streets.
Mm.
So Kashmir streets core to quad. Okay.
Mm.
So core to quad has two pairs, and each pair share 6 megabytes of L2 cache.
Mm.
So we just put two virtual machines, pin two virtual machines on the two cores belong to the same pair,
mm-hmm.
so they can compete for the cache.
Is that Intel or?
Intel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Intel. So this basically the same graph, which is too long. Each group of bus, so we join two virtual machines, right? So
mm-hmm.
basically VM1 and the VM2.
Mm-hmm.
So we group all the data by VM1. Okay.
I see.
And this is also in the order of Kashmir Street of VM1, which runs alone. Okay, so this is EN with another benchmark, and this is Lucas with another benchmark. EN has the smallest Kashmir Street when
mm-hmm.
it runs alone. Lucas has the highest. EN is basically 0%. Lucas is like 18%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then within each group, we also order the bus by VM2's standalone Kashmir Street.
I see.
So,
okay.
But you can see that as we increase the VM2's mistrace rate increases, the combined mistrace rate also increases.
Mm.
That's the basic idea. Yeah.
Mm. I see.
Yeah. Okay.
But this interesting part is that VM2's cache miss rate increases, but the group's cache miss rate does not increase monotonically.
No, that's not.
Naturally,
yeah.
You would expect that the group would increase monotonically as well.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Actually, I think the interesting thing is that when VM2, when a benchmark runs alone, it may behave differently when you run with something else. And the most obvious one is T-Wolf. So basically, within each group, T-Wolf, right? T-Wolf is the one that is that caused the highest combined cache miss rate.
Mm. So it's sort of more. Maybe it has more flooding behavior than any other.
Yes.
Mm.
But you can see the general trend.
Do you know what T-Wolf does?
I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. Yeah.
Oh.
And according to Chen's simulation result, which we use a smaller shared cache, T-Wolf is classified as a memory bound benchmark. But according to our results, it's classified as a computation bound benchmark. So you see it's kind of borderline, depending on the availability of the cache.
Right.
But isn't that always the case, that you'll have more misses if you have a smaller cache for any application?
Well, depends on the working data size, right?
Yeah.
There's some application like, I don't know, like a GZ Pro, it's just really not memory bound. So, yeah, if you have really, really small cache, maybe it becomes memory bound too, right? But, depends on the threshold and the working data size.
The Pure for the placement and global routing package used in the process of creating lithography artwork needed for the expansion of Markov chips. So, that's what Pure does. Placement and global routing.
Oh, that's chip placement.
Yeah.
The planning and...
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine what it would be doing based on that description.
So, but this says something. So, if you just profile the benchmark alone offline, right, the results may be misleading. You have profiled with something else.
But the question is that, I mean, can you do an all-to-all profile? It's not practically feasible to do that offline because you don't have all the workloads.
Yeah.
Available ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah.
As you're already running some workloads, and new workloads come in,
right?
And then you have to determine how these two workloads interact on the fly.
Yeah. So, but this also brings up the point that maybe online profiling is better, right? If we can do this online.
Well, that's one approach certainly, which is more of the experimental approach. I don't know if you're familiar with the paper that's called Just Run It. I think that's from
Middleware or.
Rutgers.
Rutgers, okay.
Rutgers University.
Yeah.
So, in that paper they talk about, well, just run the thing and figure out what's going on, and then you can adapt to that.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there is an alternate approach which we talk about in the generalized CRSS stream model, where you model applications individually. You don't have to model them together, but then based on individual models, you can predict what would happen when you combine them together.
Yeah.
So that's another approach.
Yeah. So,
but yours approach is profiled first.
Profile each individually first. Profile. It's not that you have to profile combined, because all combinations can be infeasible.
Yeah.
But before running something, you can always profile it once.
So I see that these are two interesting complementary approaches, and we can discuss both in the portfolio. But say, using the your model, would you be able to capture the behavior of people like this?
Yes, I think so, because the tables, depending on, so the ERSS stream model figures out how many phases and what are the sizes in each phase.
Yeah.
And there is a hierarchy of phases and ERSS values. Given a certain amount of cache, we can determine which phases would fit in a certain level of cache. And for each phase, we have information such as reuse rate and flood rate, which can then be utilized in combination with the other workloads, reuse rate and flood rate, to determine if they're going to be isolated or not.
Mm.
That's the whole purpose of that work.
Okay.
It's
based on reuse distance, right? Something like that. Reuse distance.
That's one part of it. We do look at the reuse rates, but there is this other metric that we define called effective reuse rate, effective reuse set size.
So you have to scan the instruction sequence.
We don't do static analysis. It's profiling.
Okay.
Yeah. So by just based on measurements, like what Dulcado did when he did combination experiments, we do the same thing, but only in isolation.
Okay. Oh, I need to take a closer look at that paper.
Yeah.
I think both online offline. But
so I think for this one, mainly interesting thing is the flood rate. Because the flood rate is causing the part that is difficult to predict when the two different location running together. Because the static part is always easy to predict, so this one, during this phase, you only need one megabyte, and you only need 2 megabytes.
Right.
That's just put them at 3 megabytes may not be the case, because that the
flooding
rate
exactly
is causing all the trouble. But then, so I think that's one thing I'm missing, is that if two applications has two different flood rate at a certain phase, and how does your model put them together and predict how much is enough?
At different phases, right? So we can always come up with a worst case scenario.
Okay.
Right. In the worst case, we mix this phase of application A with that the other phase of application B, then you have a much higher cache requirement than if you mix any other two phases together. Right?
Okay.
So we can do worst case analysis.
Okay.
Or we can do some sort of average case analysis to say, well, on an average, you need a cache of this size.
Yes.
So that they are isolated in the average case. But there may be some corner cases where they are not isolated.
Okay.
Especially when this phase mixes with that other phase.
But in Ricardo's model, I remember, it's assumed, it's based on the assumption that everything was fully associated. Which means you don't have a set associativity problem. But when you have the set associativity included, then you have a flooding rate corresponding to that set, then no matter how basic, which means that you will have a contention for the set anyway. You can increase your cache size. In cache size, basically, you kind of divided your flooding rate, because now they won't map into one set. When you increase double the size, now they might map into two sets.
Mm-hmm.
But then you keep on doubling them, you keep on doubling the set, then it will be contention. But then during each set, it's mainly the set that will cause the contention.
But I think Ricardo said that it didn't really matter all that much in the experiments because that the randomness factor of where various elements of the working set reside, maybe every element of the cache is under equal contention.
Does he observe any benchmark that, I recall that he did all the work for individual benchmark and to look at their phase change and cache behavior, right? But then how many cases he looked at when he run multiple benchmarks together and when using the ERSS model to predict the view behavior? Because I remember something in the end, but that's a very limited
cases.
It's
a very limited study
okay. In
terms of the combination. And certainly we need to do a lot more. I think what we're doing with that work is sort of providing a foundation for how you can analyze contention of multiple workloads, right? Because here we see something,
yes. Right,
when we put two things together, but we cannot quantify or come up with the reasons for why that is happening,
yes. Right?
So that work is developing the theoretical foundation for understanding why that is happening,
yeah. Right? I think that's exactly my point. And for this one, like T-Walk, maybe the one that's causing all the trouble is because the flooding. And then in that case, is how do you use that, which means that you can predict the flooding rate, but then given given that you cannot dynamically change your cache size is given, last level cache size is given, then basically what you can do under that case is limited.
Which is why we sort of focused our eventual direction in that work to just coming up with the isolation condition.
Okay. See,
are two workloads isolated or not isolated, as opposed to how do we ensure that a certain two workloads are isolated? Right. We cannot do that because there is no control on how the cache is utilized by these different workloads.
I agree.
I see strengths in both the offline approach and also the online approach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the online approach is going to be more like what Sajib is doing. It's just take a machine learning method that works well and you train the model. You don't have to understand why it behaves like that. As long as you can get a reasonable prediction accuracy, right?
Who is Sajib?
Sajib is he did the paper, the HPCA paper.
HPCA paper, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I remember someone from business school.
Kaushik. He's a faculty in the business school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so come back to this. This diagram is the runtime for the same experiment. So for runtime, it is changes, not as big as the hash miss rate.
Oh yeah, you know what? That's what you exactly might. I think that corresponds to one of the points I have is what are we discussing? Online, right? Online that machine learning algorithm, right? I think that my point from beginning to now is that with the online algorithm that you can fairly precisely catch the behavior, the behavior you try to monitor for certain application. And then in that case is first of all, that you don't need to profile the application at the beginning. That gives the freedom that you can run any applications, right? And the second of all is you offload the hardware for doing this kind of job. And the third thing is you can feed if we can construct a mechanism to feed this information back to the hardware, that would be even better. So I think that's always the other way. I think we briefly touched this last time is how do we construct the two-way communication channel between the system software and the hardware. So
by the way, we had a bit of a imaginative discussion about this.
Before you go on, I'm still curious about what you said earlier.
Yes.
Are you saying that the runtimes don't change?
Change.
They do change, right?
Do change, see the change. Yeah. Not as significant as the cache miss rate. It does change. Okay. But we are missing a lot of bars here.
No, wait a minute. What? I mean, just the range here is 0 to 80, here is 0 to 160. So the levels here don't correspond to the levels.
No, this is a percentage.
Yeah.
But this is a real time.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real...
No, but this is also percentage miss rate.
Mm-hmm. No, this is not miss rate anymore. These two are not miss rate.
I know, but this is miss rate.
I think what Roger is saying, maybe the absolute value, we have to look at the relative change, right? Relative change. One problem is this graph is missing many bars. We don't have all the bars that we have with the miss rate bars.
Yeah.
Because it's benchmark, they don't finish at the same time, so...
That's certainly something that we ran into the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we took two approaches. One is to shorten one of the applications,
mm-hmm.
The longer one. To,
mm-hmm.
But then the problem there is that you do not have the entire profile of that second
mm-hmm.
application, which
mm-hmm.
runs longer. So
mm-hmm.
what we did was we took the least common multiple of the runtimes and executed everything for exactly the same duration
mm-hmm.
in multiple times, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say one runs for 3 time cycles, the other one runs for 2,
mm-hmm.
then the total execution time is 6, where the first application would run twice and the second application would run
mm-hmm.
3 times.
But the problem is... we have many pairs of applications,
mm-hmm.
right? If we want to compare, put everybody on the same figure, they have to finish.
The LCM can be pretty high.
Yeah, right, very, very high.
But you could sort of take an approximate LCM that is not the exact LCM. You know what I mean by LCM,
I know.
Right?
So right now what we did is we just measure the time of the shorter application.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we make sure the shorter application is always under the contention of the longer one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So because of that, we miss one bus. But I can imagine we can also run the shorter one iteratively,
mm-hmm.
so that we can also take the longer ones.
Full profile. Because it's possible that the longer one has a different kind of behavior in the beginning and towards the end.
Yeah, but we don't really do profiling here, so we just do the runtime and the overall catch miss rate. So that's okay. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, I think you had a very good point. So maybe if we put everything together and if we can consider the relative performance, then maybe it's a significant catch miss rate. But the most interesting part is this one. In this guy, that's what we discussed before it came. This is on i7, okay, it's hypervalued.
Hmm.
So i7, so if we pin two virtual machines on two logical cores that belong to the
system. This is with quad core?
This is quad core, this is also quad core.
Oh.
This is core 2 quad core.
Core 2 quad core,
yeah,
which,
quad two
which
quad.
Has a shared cache.
Which has a shared last network, L2 cache.
L2 cache across all the 4 cores.
No, across
two
only
cores.
2 cores.
And there is no other cache, there is no L3.
No IFD.
Okay.
It has, I think it has 2 6-mega L2 cache.
So in this case, how do you pin the VMs to the cores? Do you pin them to the same pair of cores?
Yeah, yeah.
Not on two different processes?
If you pin them on two different
dies.
It's the same die. It's a quad core, but it has 2 pairs. Same thing.
They're the same die?
Same die, yeah. It's a quad core. Is it called quad core chip?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the one we showed at the beginning. Core 0, core 1, core 2, core 3.
I see, okay.
They share level 1, level 2,
yeah.
0, and then level 2, 1. So these two share this one, and these two share this one. So what meaning is that virtual machine 1 is here, virtual machine 2 is here. So,
I see. They're sharing
yeah.
L2 then.
Yeah.
Okay. And here in this i7, what's happening?
This is the more interesting. This is old quad core, and I think old 4 cores share L3. I don't know.
No. It's like now core i7 has a level 3.
Right.
Yes.
Core i7 has a level 3.
They all share L3, right?
They all share level 3.
Yes.
Right. But what about L2?
L2 is private to each core.
It's private.
Yeah,
and that suggests why you have. But what is the size of the L2 here and the L2 in
I7?
Here it's 6 megabytes.
Right.
And
so what happened is, for here you have level 1, level 2 for each core. This is a core.
Uh-huh.
And this is 256 kilobytes.
L2 is 256 kilobytes.
Yeah, for each core.
Okay.
And then you have core 0, 1, 2, 3, right?
Okay.
And
L3, how big is that?
8.
Ah, yes, of course. okay, because you cannot really compare those two, because this guy is 8 megabytes.
Well, without comparing them, no. Without comparing them, we are comparing all the numbers on the same
right,
platform.
Right. But I'm saying that here, it's not very surprising that the applications are better isolated. Here, the applications are better isolated.
Why?
Because this is a much larger.
The other guy has a remaining of the story.
Yeah.
I think me you can finish
okay.
The remaining of the.
Yeah,
story.
I think so. Then there's hyper-threading, right? So imagine we pin the two virtual machines and the two logical cores that belong to the same core zero.
So this is virtual machine one.
Right. They would also compete.
What is TC corresponding to? Because of
no, but they compete on L2, that's fine.
Yeah.
They don't compete on L3. They compete to a lesser extent on L3. The last level cache here is 8 megabytes.
Yes, but the thing is that we are not considering everything else is idle.
Sure.
So they are competing with each other.
They
have head to head.
Sure. Yeah.
So, they can be everything, including the computation resource.
Sure, but this guy is so small, 256 kilobytes, that this is not going to be as effective as the L2 over there, right? So, most of the time, the majority of the working set, I would assume, will be in this level.
Yeah.
So, this level, even though you compete, it doesn't really matter because most of the time you're accessing L3 anyway.
Yeah, that could be one of the reasons. Okay, but this is 8 mega. Okay, this is 6 mega.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't see it's not substantially bigger. But you remember Ken last mentioned that the Intel hyper-threading precision the 5-cube.
Mm-hmm.
So which means that these two threads they only have a limited depth in their cube. So that reduces the contention between them. That may be the bigger reason here.
It's possible. It's certainly possible. What would be interesting to confirm that is to look at the last level cache misses. I mean,
if you get
L3 cache
yeah,
miss rate.
Yeah. That problem, we don't have that number because that problem does not work on 7. But from the runtime, I would say that the cache miss rate would be the same because the runtime is not changed at all. You can see some of the benchmark is just completely flat. I would imagine, even though this is larger last level cache, there still should be some variation. But I don't see any variation at all.
Yes, I think both reasons are possible at this point. Without further information, it's hard to tell.
I don't know, yeah. But my bet is that the static precision of the fast queue. That isolates how many instructions a thread can issue. So even you have a guy that is a really memory bound, but its content is limited by the number of instructions it can issue.
So you're saying that somehow the flood rate is controlled?
It's controlled, yeah.
Possible.
Yeah. And I think that's also confirmed by the fact that when I run two computation bound benchmarks together,
mm-hmm.
they don't contact, they don't interfere each other either.
Mm-hmm. So here the core, so you are pinning VM1 and VM2 on the same core.
Yeah.
On the same core.
Yes.
The same physical core,
yes.
But they are two virtual cores.
Yes.
I see. Yeah. Because there's two threads.
Right. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, the end result may be a combination of both.
What about the runtime, absolute runtime?
This is absolute runtime. We don't have such measures.
No, but the absolute runtime here is higher.
So the absolute runtime, what do you mean? It's rather low?
No, here in contention, the absolute runtimes are higher in this case than in this case.
Because this is multi-threaded, right?
It's multi-threaded, yeah.
It has each thread has less resource. Yeah, this is much bigger than that. Yeah.
So you cannot. There is no way to get the last level cache misses here.
We can try. Yeah.
Can we profile in terms of? Can we get any information about the issue policy or and what is the those kinds of things in i7 in terms of any hyper threading related counters. Are there any hyper-threading related counters in i7?
probably what he needs to propose.
But I mean, before he proposes anything,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
good
yeah.
to know what
know,
already
it
exists.
Is, yeah.
Yeah, that's something I need to look into.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite sure about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a traditional Intel conference doesn't have anything.
What is interesting is that the times here are 3 times higher than the times here, at least for several benchmarks.
Yeah.
Right. For this, it is 3 times higher. For
yeah,
this, it's three times higher.
Not higher. Yeah. Yeah.
This it's well 2.5 times higher.
Yeah, that's what I
brought
up with Ming at the beginning. You see.
Here again, 3 times higher.
You see, Roger, on top, you see green and red, and black, right? So the green is for each virtual machine that when they're running alone, then they're running by themselves, in fact, T1, T2. But then when you're running Harvest, right, you run together, what happens is for each one of them, their time is extended.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you run two of them on the same call, what happens is that you expect that you mix them together to execute.
Mm-hmm.
So you achieve the result is your total runtime should be less than T1 plus T2.
You know, one easy way to verify what we are saying
mm-hmm.
is to pin VM2 onto a different core. They will still contend on the last level cache.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the execution times will probably be lower.
Much lower.
But
yeah.
the uniformity in the execution times or the isolation may be similar to this.
So if you do that, then the natural behavior is for VM1 and VM2, they would behave like T1 and T2.
Mm.
Yeah,
but then when you put them together, they are behaving more like T1 prime and T2 prime.
Yeah, we have some numbers. I think because we did that experiment to find out which notch codes belong to the same physical core.
Mm.
And the way we do it, we run Lucas with another benchmark, with different benchmarks.
Mm.
And we run them on different core pairs.
Mm.
And we only see difference when we pin these two on core 3 and core 7.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Core 3 and core 7?
Yes. That's how Linux does it. Okay.
So core 0 and core...
So 0 and the core 4. 5,
4.
4. Okay.
Uh-huh.
1 and 5. Yeah. But on Windows is different. But Windows is 6 and 7.
Uh-huh.
So when we pin, so we fix one virtual machine on core 7 and run the other one from 0 to all the way to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we do, basically the performance of Lucas is the same. Exactly when it runs on core 3. So if I remember correctly, I think there's no contention. There's no contention when they put two separate cores.
Right.
Even though they can pin for L3.
Right. So that's sort of supports what I was saying earlier. This is big enough to isolate them. So that they either, you know, the whether you run it
mm.
together or in combination or in isolation, the run times are the same.
Mm.
But that would be a good thing to see exact numbers for what happens when you do the same chart but on two different cores.
So
the other thing here, though, is that, I mean, although these look very similar,
mm.
I think you should look at percentages. Right, you should look at percentages because this the magnitude here is larger than the magnitude here. So a small
I also need to take it might be just within the variance. Maybe it does not make sense because it drops and actually this should be higher. This can see some higher. Mm. But also in general the impact is small. And the other thing is that Sam has this so-called smart cache. This is some Intel technology that can dynamically allocate national cache across cores on demand.
But the cache already does that. I mean, even LRU caches do that.
So what does that really mean?
What I really mean is, I think for Core 7, what happened is that each core is originally associated with 2 megabyte cache.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So it's automatically partitioned.
You wanna you wanna use the other part of the other core than that you need that.
So that's not that last thing you really, right?
Huh?
It's not anything that we should consider, because that's what we already assume. If one virtual machine is a memory bound, it can take 100% of the L2 cache, right?
Not really.
If all the others are not.
What you're talking about is the associativity, but assuming that the application is, you know, occupies random locations in memory, then its working set can occupy the entire cache if it is memory bound.
Yeah. Okay. That's really what smart cache is about. I watched the demo yesterday, and it was like, yes, one core can take 100% of, 100% of the application. Anyway,
but that's interesting. I mean, this is the direction we are going in for the proposals. We can certainly use some of this for motivation.
No, I think this is something here is bad for us, because there's no threat level contention. If there's no threat level contention, then there's nothing we can do. the hardware scheduler.
No, that's
what do you mean?
Because when you put them as two threads, like at least the Intel hyper threading, they don't contend. They don't compete with each other.
You don't compete with each other?
They don't see the contention. They don't see that.
I don't know why you say that. I mean,
because this is represented by the runtime numbers. There's no, you don't see the contention. No matter what is we imagine that if you put two computation bound virtual machines on the same core, right, they would compete for the computation resources. And I don't see that contention in runtime.
Okay. I see what you mean. Because the runtimes are more or less the same, irrespective of which application you combine with the application.
Right.
Yeah. It would be good to look at the percentage values, though.
Yeah.
I mean, although the absolute values don't differ all much in terms of percentage values.
Right?
Maybe not a whole lot. Maybe 5% in the worst case.
Yeah. So what do you think, if we put two, if we run the same computing bound benchmark, the same one, twice at the same time, that will take the longest time. It's not in this diagram.
You know the other reason for why that might be the case is because the last level cache is not contended upon.
But I'm talking about computation bound.
There can be both computation and memory bound, right? So, for instance, if there is adequate space in the last level cache, then the CPU, the hyperthreads are not stalled for getting data from memory. They always get it from last level cache because big enough, right?
But I would say that's more important for memory bound benchmark.
Probably, yeah. But even for CPU bound benchmarks, they have some working set, right?
Mm.
They have some working set, and if it doesn't, let's say, fit in the shared L1 and L2 caches, and you need to go into L3, and then L3 is being shared by all of these hyperthreads, and there is fewer L3 cache for each of those hyperthreads, then there may be more stalls on cache misses, on L1 and L2 cache misses, because L3 would also miss, and then you had to go to memory, and then the pipelines are going to be stuck or occupied.
I agree. Yeah, I think what I can do is I can, instead of letting the other cores I/O, can run something there. So
you could, could run some cache occupying benchmark. I think Ricardo wrote one which uses a specific instruction in Intel, which just the only thing it does is to load cache lines.
Mm.
There's one in hardware instruction that does that. So then you can control very carefully how much cache is being occupied by a certain application. Because it's doing fast enough, it's reusing its items fast enough so that it always stays in the cache. Any other kind of regular executable will not have that behavior, because you'll have computer, you have load store, and you have arithmetic, and you have all of those other things. Whereas this would just do cache line pollution.
Maybe we can borrow that from Ricardo. But the other thing I was trying to say is that
If they are computation bound, they should also compete for computation resources, like ALUs, etc. If they are, say, and the old benchmarks, computation bound benchmarks, I consider they are integer benchmarks. So they should compete for the integer resources.
Well, when you say compete, there is a fixed amount of resources, and if both processors, both processes are always utilizing all the resources very well, then that's fine. I mean, you won't see any competition because the resources are being fairly divided across these two.
We are trying to advocate that you want to put two virtual machines that has the complementary behaviors on the same core, right? So in that sense, if you put two computing bonds that would compete for the same computing resources, like ARUs, that would be bad. So instead, maybe you should put one computing bond and one memory bond. Because the memory bound one will not compete for the ARUs.
Well, I think Chen had a different. I thought a different kind of argument, which is that if you put memory bound, which is stalling on cache misses, then it's going to occupy processor resources that for nothing, and waste processor resources, right?
So you want to put one computing bound and one memory bound.
But even the computation bound cannot use the resources that are occupied by the memory bound because it's occupying all those pipeline stages for long periods of time, and no one can use those resources.
Is that okay?
Yeah, what you mean is there is no control. There is no control.
Right.
And for this case, it's alleviated to some degree because the queues are divided by two, and then your memory bound cannot be that aggressively polluting the other thread. So the one you're making progress, or the one, that's what I think the thing is, for VM1, you're only looking at the one who finishes first. The one who finishes first normally takes, can progress very fast. And then it's speed only limited by the resources it can have, for using half of the resources only.
I mean, if we talk about SMP, SMT in general, then if I run one computing bound, one memory bound, and memory bound is stored for memory size, that will prevent the computing bound to progress. To progress?
Yeah.
Why? But you cannot do out of order execution? Why? Why is that?
No, the thing is, for example, if I'm my instruction queue is 128.
Uh-huh.
64, for example.
Uh-huh.
And then the thing, I can only execute an instruction is I scan my instruction here from the beginning to the end.
Uh-huh.
Then whenever I found a ready instruction, I execute them. So I execute them out of order, right? But however, if now the thing, if I have two threads, and then so the two threads fit in the instruction queue.
Mm-hmm.
And however, if I have a cache miss. If I have a cache miss, then one of the instructions being executed then doesn't have the operand. So then there are many other instructions following that instruction, maybe depending on that operand to return. Then those instructions will not be able to exit progress. And then those instructions are wasting the instruction queue to which basically the occupied instruction queue cannot do anything. And then this, on the other hand, is kind of reduce the instruction queue you can use for the other thread to progress. Because that's the story, you cannot say that I can always progress because I myself might have other dependencies also. And then so in the end, what happens is the instruction queue you can have is fairly limited, and then it also hurts the performance of the other thread.
So does this mean that the only bad combination is memory bound and memory bound, and all the others are fine? It can be.
I think what Chen is saying, that the memory bound process can affect the compute bound process also.
I know. So now you have. I'm trying to figure out what should be the combination that the virtual machine scheduler should be looking for, right? So you can put a computing bound with a computing bound, or computing bound with a memory bound, or memory bound with a memory bound. Okay. So I need to see somewhere.
What are the good policies?
Yes. Yeah,
I think compute bound with compute bound is fine.
It's fine, okay.
Memory bound with memory bound is fine.
It's fine too?
Yeah, because they're going to be messed up anyway, no matter what, because they're memory bound, right? So even if you put two messed up things together, they still remain messed up, right? And when you put compute bound with memory bound,
then the memory bound will mess up the compute bound guy, and that's bad. Is that, does that make sense?
Oh, that's just complete theology. That's what I thought. I thought that we should advocate it for the mixed scheduling. We should always put the computing bound with the memory bound, right? And that's reflecting on the quarterly result, not on the I7 result. You see, if you put two memory bonds, assuming there's other cores available, right? If you put all the memory bonds on the same core, the high speed rate would be really, really high.
It all depends on what happens when you put a memory bound with a compute bound. What happened to the compute bound? And I think, you know, even last time, this was my understanding based on what Chen said, is that the compute bound can be affected because the memory bound will occupy processor resources. And
I don't know. Yeah, but on core 2, that's okay. It's on core 2, there's no contention in that sense. You can see that the compute bound is not affected by the memory
bound. Which one? Core, this one?
Yeah, core 2, right. So these are all...
Is that SMT or no?
No.
It's not SMT.
Yeah, but for SMT, I don't know. I don't see any difference with SMT, so...
But those are... So it would be good to see which one.
Your paper is memory.
Okay, so
I'm really confused.
So memory bond. So Roger saying memory bond with ready memory bond is good because they're gonna be messed up anyway, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, you need to consider that so you only have in that case, you need to consider limited
memory bandwidth. Yeah.
Memory bandwidth and the causing the result is both of the memory bond they mess up with each other. The result then the basically what's gonna happen is that your throughput will be reduced. Because in the end, if you look at the throughput point of view, is you put two things together. The only reason you put two things together is because you can finish them in less time.
No, but wait a minute. You're saying memory bandwidth is going to be the bottleneck.
Yeah.
But that would be the bottleneck no matter what, even if you put them on two different cores, right? Because all the cores share the memory bus.
I think you should continue this discussion because we only have 10 minutes. And he has a paper which is done on a simulation, right? Actually show that the mixed scheduling, which schedule a compute bound and a memory bound, is better.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should read that paper.
Yeah, you can.
So there are two things. One thing is we should put the opposite behavior benchmarks together. And another thing is when we put them together, we want to control. We want to put them actually in a control manner.
In a control manner. But not. But what about I7? Does it do control in a manner?
The control manner is like that.
The queue size.
The queue size.
Statically.
So in your papers, you do anything to control that?
I did two things. There are two papers I read. One thing I said is
That one on the better use of what happened at
that one didn't do partition.
Okay,
didn't do partition. The only thing is that if we put two things together, then the performance is better. Just
you do anything that controls the behavior in that paper, because that paper shows that the mixed scheduling is much better than model scheduling, right?
Yeah.
So you think you have another paper, you should also send it to us.
I
did. What do you mean the impact that one?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, okay. Maybe we should come back to this discussion. But I really want to divide tasks.
Sure.
This is very simple to outline, right? So I shamelessly borrowed Roger's template. So we have an instruction, research overview, and the three thrusts or aspects, and the project management and the body impact, right?
Okay.
So I think if it doesn't make sense for everybody, maybe Roger can start on the middleware level challenges. The title can change.
Okay.
And the Chen can start at hardware level challenges, right? And I will start on the introduction. I will provide something, a draft for introduction and research overview, and then I move on to the virtual machine level challenges.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah. It's good we're having this discussion now because I'll probably work throughout the Thanksgiving weekend on this stuff.
Okay.
And hopefully I should have something by the end of this weekend.
Good.
When do you want to meet next?
next Monday or later during the week? Are we meeting on Wednesday? Well, actually, Wednesday, it doesn't work for me.
If you want, we meet again, yeah.
But I think Thursday through Friday.
Mm.
Thursday through Friday. Well, I can come here on Thursday, but that's Thanksgiving.
Maybe we can try Skype if.
Skype? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, maybe.
Maybe Friday then.
Maybe Friday.
Yeah.
Friday.
If it makes sense to meet, okay, because we have an upcoming meeting on Monday, right?
Okay.
So if we have, accumulated enough questions or progress, then we can.
When are we going to meet next week?
The same time.
Same time.
Next week I'll be on time at 9:30 a.m. This week I messed up.
I'll be on time too. Okay. Alright.
Okay.
Okay. So then we can divide and divide and conquer.
I think it would be good to have, some discussion maybe next Monday or on Friday or Saturday, something like that, to identify, I know we have a Google Doc, but for you, Ming, once you have some ideas on the introduction to discuss that as to what you think should be the sort of high-level directions for the proposal.
Mm.
I think as you start writing, you might get some ideas as to how, what are the things that across these three levels, what are the cross-layer issues and things like that.
Mm. Yeah.
So I guess I'm referring to section 2 rather than introduction.
Yeah, I love, yeah.
Given context.
My proposal writing is backwards.
It's backwards.
Yeah, so.
That's fine,
either
way.
I think we already have some basic ideas on what we can put in each level, right?
Mm.
So, at the middle of our level is, we just discussed about that. We can do offline and online, basically taking information from the hardware to improve the profiling or modeling. And at the hardware level, we also discussed about that. One thing we can actually investigate is what kind of information the hardware should provide to facilitate the software level decisions.
Right.
And the other thing is because hardware level schedule relies on detection of phase changes, things like that, then we can move some of those kind of modeling tasks back to the software level. But for that, that's cross layer. That is cross layer, but that's because that's machine learning algorithm you need to run does not have to be part of the middleware or virtual machine model. It can be just another virtual machine, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, then it's up to you. So because you can decide which layer it's on.
Okay. So. What we need is to each one of us need to propose some concrete ideas at each level that we believe we can do, and then when we meet again later this week or Monday, then we should connect all the dots together and see what are the cross layers issues that we should address.
Yeah.
Right. And maybe there are things that the ideas that we propose, we are thinking at each individual level, but that makes sense when we put everything together, then we can skip that too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I sort of see there are two levels of decision making that's going on. How much resources to allocate to each VM, right? How much in terms of CPU, the percentage CPU, and so on. Then the other level of decision making is the isolation of our core and cache resources, right? Should I put these two virtual machines on the same core or schedule them at the same time on the same, or no, right? On the same core, a set of cores.
Like a matching problem, right?
There are two, one is an allocation problem and the other is a mapping problem.
Right.
So I'm wondering, I think both of those go in here, right? In the middleware level challenges.
I see that most of our discussion so far is about Mati.
At least recently, yes.
Yeah.
But previously we've looked at, you know, the HPC work, and all of that is about allocation too, right?
Yeah.
On a
I think that makes sense too, because even though we cannot allocate cache space, we can allocate additional CPU resource, CPU cycles to compensate for the contention of the cache. But then that will be more like a QoS driven, not a system throughput driven.
Okay, sounds good. All right.